Welcome back, everyone, to another deep dive, and today we're taking a closer look at the writing style of the Gospel of John.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be using the work of Dr. Robert A. Peterson to kind of unpack what makes John so distinct, so unique in how he communicates his message about Jesus. And, you know, I think sometimes when we talk about writing style, it sounds kind of, I don't know, academic, like who cares?
Right.
But really, understanding how John writes can help us, you know, the average reader, to understand the text better and maybe even make some surprising discoveries.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, if you think of John as an artist and he's trying to paint this portrait of Jesus, he's not only choosing, you know, what colors to use, but also the brush strokes, the techniques, the way he applies the paint.
Right.
All of that contributes to the overall effect, the message he's trying to convey. And that's what we're going to explore today.
Exactly. So what are some of those techniques, those brush strokes that Dr. Peterson highlights in John's writing?
Well, he points out several things like double meanings in the words that John uses, a clever structural pattern called chiasm, which we'll talk more about, and his frequent changes in vocabulary, which is known as variation. There's also a lot of connections to the Old Testament in John and this idea of ethical dualism, and even his use of overstatement,
mm-hmm.
you know, what we call hyperbole, to really emphasize certain points. So it's a rich tapestry of techniques that all come together to create this incredibly powerful and moving portrait of Jesus.
Yeah, I love that. It's a tapestry. It's a work of art. And I think that's so helpful to remember as we're reading John's gospel. So let's start with this idea of double meaning.
Sure.
Dr. Peterson talks about how John frequently uses words that have two valid interpretations, two meanings within the same context.
Yeah, and you know, I think at first glance, someone might say, wait a minute, a word can only have one meaning, right?
Right, right.
And in most cases, that's true. But John, he seems to intentionally bend that rule. He does it so often that it can't be just a coincidence. It's clearly a deliberate stylistic choice he's making.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's important to point out. It's not accidental. He's doing this on purpose. So can you give us an example of that?
Absolutely. In John 1:14, it says that the word dwelt among us. Now, at the surface level, the meaning of dwelt is simply, you know, to live or reside somewhere for a time. But the Greek word that John uses here, skenaju, has this connection to the Old Testament idea of the tabernacle, you know, that portable sanctuary where God's presence would dwell among his people.
Right, yeah.
So dwelt here also carries that sense of tabernacled among us.
Wow, that's really interesting. So John is subtly connecting Jesus to God's presence in the Old Testament right from the very beginning.
Precisely. And he's hinting at this idea that Jesus isn't just visiting us. He's establishing God's presence among us in a new and permanent way. And as Dr. Peterson points out, we see this theme kind of reappear in John chapter 2, when Jesus talks about the temple being replaced by his own body.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he's becoming the new dwelling place of God. That's a pretty significant idea.
It is, yeah. And another example of this double meaning is found in John chapter 3, with the famous phrase, born again.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people take this literally, as in being physically born a second time. And it's understandable, because that's one of the meanings of the Greek word anton. But it also means from above, indicating a spiritual origin, you know, being born from God.
Oh, okay, so it has both of those meanings.
Yes, it does. And it's brilliant, because when Nicodemus, you know, he hears Jesus talk about being born again, and he takes it literally, Jesus uses that misunderstanding as an opportunity to point him toward this deeper spiritual reality.
Right. Yeah.
He's saying you need to be born not just physically but spiritually from God.
I love the idea that John is using these double meanings to kind of make us think, to challenge our assumptions.
Yeah, he's not giving us like a simple, straightforward message. He's inviting us to engage with the text, to wrestle with it, to discover those deeper layers of meaning.
Right, right. Dr. Peterson uses this great analogy. He compares it to a river.
Oh, yeah.
Where a child can wade in the shallows, but an elephant can swim in the depths. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a perfect picture of John's writing. It's accessible on one level, but there's so much depth there for those who are willing to dive in.
Exactly. There's something for everyone. And the more you explore, the more you discover.
And we see this layering of meaning again in John 4:10-14 with the living water.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah. On the surface, it's just about, you know, fresh flowing water, which is obviously important in a physical sense. But Jesus uses it as a symbol for something much deeper, spiritual water.
Mm.
And Dr. Peterson suggests that this could refer to eternal life, the gift that Jesus gives, Or it could even refer to the Holy Spirit himself, who brings that eternal life.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And again, it's not that we have to choose one meaning over the other. I think John is inviting us to consider both and how they kind of work together to paint this fuller picture of what Jesus is offering.
Yeah, it's like they complement each other. They both contribute to the richness of the passage. So far we've talked about double meaning. Now let's move on to this idea of chiasm.
Okay.
Which sounds a bit technical, but it's actually a pretty fascinating way that John structures some of his writing.
It is, yeah. And it's not as complicated as it might sound. Basically, chiasm is a kind of inverted parallelism.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in regular parallelism, you might have a structure that goes A, B, B, A. Like you introduce an idea, then you develop it, then you kind of mirror that development, and then you come back to the original idea.
Okay, yeah.
But in chiasm, the second half of the structure is reversed. So it's A, B, B prime, A prime.
Okay, so it's kind of like a mirror image, but flipped.
Exactly. Like, you know, if you fold it in half, the corresponding elements would line up.
Oh, okay, I get it.
And John uses this chiastic structure to connect related ideas and to draw attention to the central point, which is often found in the middle.
So it's like he's building this literary sandwich, and the most important part is the filling in the middle.
That's a great way to put it, yeah. And a great example of this is found right at the beginning of John's gospel, in the prologue, in John 1:1-14.
Okay.
So Dr. Peterson breaks it down like this. The word appears in verses 1-14, so that's our A. Then the light is mentioned in verse 8, that's B. And then in verse 9, we have the true light coming into the world, which is like a variation on the idea of light.
Mm-hmm.
So that's B prime. And finally, in verse 14, we come back to the word became flesh, echoing the initial statement about the word. So that's A prime,
okay.
A, B, B prime, A prime.
Yeah, I see. So what's the significance of that struggle? Like, what's John trying to emphasize by using this chiasm?
Well, in this case, it's all about the incarnation, the idea that the divine word, who was with God in the beginning, became flesh and dwelt among us in the person of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And notice how the actual statement of the incarnation, the word became flesh, appears only once, right in the middle of this chiastic structure.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It's like it's the central point of the whole prologue.
Exactly. John is building this elaborate framework around that core truth, that central truth, to draw our attention to it.
That's fascinating. So he's using this literary structure to reinforce his theological message.
He is. And Dr. Peterson also mentions a couple of other examples of chiasm in John. He briefly mentions John 6:36-40, which deals with seeing and not believing, as well as preservation, but we don't have all the details here. But he does go into another fascinating example in John 12:37-40, which links the themes of belief and unbelief to prophecies from Isaiah. So in this passage, the chiasm unfolds like this. We have Isaiah's word and the lack of belief in verse 38, that's our A. Then a direct quotation from Isaiah 53 in the second part of verse 38, so that's B. Then in verse 39, the statement about their inability to believe, again connected to Isaiah, so B prime. And finally, in verses 39 and 40, a quotation from Isaiah 6 concerning the blinding and hardening of hearts, which is directly tied to their unbelief. That completes our A prime.
So again, we see that A, B, B prime, A prime pattern. And it's not just a coincidence, right? John is doing this intentionally.
Exactly. He's using this structure to connect the rejection of Jesus in his own time to very specific prophecies in the Old Testament, particularly Isaiah 53, which foretold the Messiah's rejection. It's like he's saying, this isn't happening by surprise. This was all part of God's plan revealed long ago.
Wow, that's powerful. It really highlights how John was very carefully constructing this gospel.
Absolutely.
He's not just telling a story. He's making a theological argument.
And he's doing it in a way that is both beautiful and persuasive.
Okay, so we've talked about double meaning, we've talked about chiasm. Now let's move on to variation.
Okay.
Which Dr. Peterson also highlights as a key feature of John's writing. He mentions the work of Leon Morris, who observed that John frequently changes his vocabulary and word order, often using different words to express similar ideas.
Right, and you know, we all do that to some extent when we're speaking. Like if you're trying to explain something, you might say it in a few different ways to make sure people understand.
Right, to keep it interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
To avoid repetition.
And it seems that John does something similar in his writing.
Okay. But Dr. Peterson takes this observation a step further.
He does, yeah, because he points out that since variation is so common in John, when he doesn't vary his vocabulary, it could be a deliberate way of emphasizing a particular word or idea. like, if you're used to someone wearing all sorts of colorful clothes and then one day they show up wearing all black, you're going to notice, right?
Right. Yeah, you're going to pay attention.
So in the same way, when John consistently uses the same word or phrase, it's like he's saying, hey, pay attention to this. This is important.
So it's like variation can be a way of emphasizing something by its absence.
Exactly. And Dr. Peterson gives a few examples of this. For instance, he talks about the two Greek words for love that John uses, agapacho and philicho. And he also mentions variations in how John refers to no, sheep, and lambs. And in many cases, it seems like John is simply varying his language for stylistic reasons.
Okay.
But he cautions us against automatically assuming that every time John uses a different word, it means something completely different.
Right.
Like philicho isn't always meant to be a lesser form of love than agapacho. Sometimes it's just John using a different shade of the same color, so to speak.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, this reminds me of something Dr. Peterson mentioned about Leon Morris studying the occurrences of the word abide in John 15. And even there, Morris found variations in almost every instance.
That's right. So while variation can sometimes highlight a nuance, it's important to remember that it can also just be part of John's natural way of expressing himself. The key is to be aware of this tendency and to pay extra attention when John doesn't vary his language.
Okay, so it's like we need to be sensitive to John's linguistic habits, kind of like we're getting to know a new friend and learning how they communicate.
Exactly. The more familiar we become with John's style, the better we'll be able to understand his message.
Okay, let's move on to another fascinating aspect of John's writing, the connections to the Old Testament. Dr. Peterson emphasizes that the first 12 chapters of John's Gospel are absolutely packed with allusions to the Old Testament. And understanding these connections is often key to unlocking the full meaning of the text.
Yes, it's like John is constantly having a conversation with the Old Testament, drawing on its stories, its imagery, its themes, to illuminate who Jesus is and what he came to do.
Right, it's like he's building on that foundation. And one crucial example that Dr. Peterson highlights is John 1:17. The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And he explains that the phrase grace and truth is deeply rooted in the Old Testament. It reflects the Hebrew terms hesed, which is God's covenantal love, and emeth, which means faithfulness.
And you see this pairing frequently in the Old Testament, in places like Exodus 34 and throughout the Psalms, describing God's character.
Okay, so John is using language that would have been familiar to his Jewish audience.
Absolutely. And he's making this bold statement that while the law was given through Moses, something even greater has come through Jesus, grace and truth.
But it's important to note that Dr. Peterson doesn't see this as a complete disjunction between the Old and New Testaments.
No, he's not saying that the law was bad or that it had no grace or truth.
Right.
It's more like he's making a comparison. He's saying that the grace and truth revealed in Jesus are so much greater, so much more complete, that they kind of overshadow the previous expressions of God's grace and truth in the Old Testament.
It's like comparing a small candle to the sun.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Or, you know, think about the difference between the dawn and high noon. Both are light, but one is obviously much more brilliant and powerful.
Yeah, I like that.
And that's similar to how the glory of Moses is compared to the glory of Christ in 2 Corinthians 3.
Right, right. So it's not that the Old Testament is wrong or bad, but it's been fulfilled and surpassed in Jesus.
Exactly.
Okay, another significant Old Testament link is found in John 1:51, where Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man."
Yeah, that's a very vivid image. And Dr. Peterson points out that this is a direct allusion to Jacob's dream in Genesis 28, where he sees a ladder connecting heaven and earth with angels going up and down.
Oh, that's right, Jacob's ladder. So is John saying that Jesus is like a new Jacob's ladder?
In a sense, yes. Dr. Peterson emphasizes that Jesus is presenting himself as the new connection between heaven and earth, the one through whom access to God is now opened. He's the true mediator, the reality that Jacob's ladder foreshadowed.
So it's not necessarily about Jesus' second coming at this point, but about his present role as the bridge between humanity and God.
Exactly. He's the way, the truth, and the life, as he says elsewhere in John's Gospel.
Okay, we also see this interplay between the Old and New Testaments in Martha's statement about the resurrection in John 11:24.
Mm-hmm.
She says, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." And Dr. Peterson notes that her understanding aligns with Old Testament teachings, like in Daniel 12 and possibly Isaiah 25:8 and 26:19, where the hope of a future resurrection is present.
But then Jesus goes one step further, doesn't he? He declares, "I am the resurrection and the life."
Right, right. So he's not just promising a future resurrection. He's embodying it in the present.
Exactly. He's the source of life, both now and in the future.
Okay, and finally, Dr. Peterson discusses John 15.1, where Jesus says, "I am the true vine."
Yeah, another powerful statement.
And this is obviously connected to the Old Testament imagery of Israel as God's vine or vineyard, which we see in Isaiah 5.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Peterson clarifies that the word true in John doesn't simply mean not false. It has a richer meaning. It means something like genuine, complete, fulfilling its intended purpose.
Right. It's like Jesus is the true vine, the one who perfectly embodies what Israel was meant to be but failed to be. He's the one who truly bears fruit, the fruit of eternal life.
So all of these examples show how deeply embedded John's gospel is in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And understanding these connections really helps us to appreciate the richness and depths of his message. It's like we're unlocking secret codes that reveal even deeper layers of meaning.
That's a great way to put it. It's like John is inviting us to see Jesus through the lens of the Old Testament, to see how he fulfills and surpasses all that came before him.
Okay, let's move on to the concept of ethical dualism in John.
Sure.
Now, Dr. Peterson is careful to distinguish this from other types of dualism.
Mm-hmm.
He jokingly refers to the light side and dark side idea, like in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the philosophical notion of two eternally opposing forces, like
right.
good and evil being equal and opposite.
Yeah, that's not what John's talking about.
Right. Dr. Peterson stresses that biblically there is one true God, the source of all good.
Mm-hmm.
And evil is not an equal and opposite force. It's more like a corruption, a distortion of what is good.
Right. It's like a parasite that feeds off of what is good, but has no independent existence.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. So when we talk about dualism in John, it's not about two rival gods or powers.
No.
It's about an ethical dualism, a stark contrast between opposing moral and spiritual realities.
Right. It's about the choices we make, the paths we choose to follow.
And Dr. Peterson gives several examples of these ethical dualisms in John. Above and below, spirit and flesh, truth and falsehood, death and life.
Mm-hmm.
So these are not equal powers, but rather choices, realities that stand in opposition to one another.
Exactly. And one example of this is found in John 3.19-21, where John talks about the coming of light into the world, which is Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that the light doesn't eliminate darkness, but rather it reveals people's love for darkness, their evil deeds, which leads to judgment. However, those who do what is true are drawn to the light. And this kind of echoes John 1.9, where it talks about Jesus being the true light that gives light to everyone.
So it's like Jesus' presence exposes what's really in people's hearts.
Exactly. It forces them to make a choice to either embrace the light or to cling to the darkness.
Okay. Another example of this contrast is in John 3.31, with the distinction between the one who comes from above, which is Christ, and the one who is of the earth, John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
And John highlights their different origins, their different authorities, the different nature of their messages.
Right. One is speaking from a divine perspective, the other from a human perspective.
Okay. And then in John 5.24, we have this powerful dualism of death and life.
Mm-hmm.
And John says that those who hear Jesus's words and believe in the one who sent him, they transition from a state of spiritual death to a state of spiritual life.
Right. It's a present reality of resurrection and regeneration.
It's not something that happens in the future. It happens now.
Exactly. It's the power of the gospel to transform us from the inside out.
And Dr. Peterson also analyzes the dualism in John 15 concerning the true vine and the branches.
Mm-hmm.
He explains that those who are in Jesus, they include both those who bear fruit and those who do not.
Right.
But the bearing of fruit, that's what distinguishes true discipleship and leads to the glorification of the Father.
Mm-hmm.
But those branches that fail to produce fruit, they're ultimately moved and face judgment.
Yeah, it's a sobering image.
Yeah.
And it illustrates fundamental ethical choice that we all face. To either embrace the light and life offered by Jesus or to cling to darkness and death.
And he connects us back to the consistent biblical principle that genuine faith will produce fruit.
Mm-hmm.
But he also acknowledges that there are varying degrees of fruitfulness among believers, as we see in the parable of the soils.
Right. Not everyone produces the same amount or type of fruit, but everyone who is truly connected to Jesus will bear some fruit.
Okay, so this ethical dualism in John, it's not about a cosmic battle of equal forces.
No.
It's about the critical choice that each person faces
mm-hmm.
to either embrace the light and life offered by Jesus or to cling to darkness and death.
And that choice has eternal consequences.
Right. Okay, let's delve into the last stylistic feature Dr. Peterson discusses. Hyperbole.
Okay.
Which he playfully calls sanctified overstatement.
Yeah, I like that.
It's about using intentional exaggeration to make a point.
Right. It's not about lying or deceiving, but about using strong language to grab the listener's attention and drive home a point.
And we've already seen an example of this in John 1.17, the comparison between the law given through Moses and the grace and truth that came through Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
That was a hyperbole.
It was. And another clear instance of hyperbole is found in John 3.77, where John says, "For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him."
Okay.
Now, Dr. Peterson clarifies that while the primary purpose of Jesus' coming was indeed salvation, condemnation is a real consequence for those who reject him.
Okay.
So the hyperbole here is in emphasizing God's primary intention, which is to save the world.
Right, but it doesn't negate the reality of judgment for those who refuse to believe.
Exactly. It's like, imagine a doctor who goes to a remote village to offer free health care to the people there.
Mm-hmm.
His primary goal is to heal them, to save their lives. But some people might refuse his treatment, and they might even get worse as a result. That doesn't mean the doctor's original intention was to harm them.
Right, right. It's just a natural consequence of their choice.
Exactly. And that's what's happening in John 3.17. God's primary desire is to save the world through Jesus, but those who reject Jesus will face the consequences of their rejection.
Okay. And then Dr. Peterson examines John 15.22 and 24, where Jesus says, "If I had not come and spoken to them, they would not have been guilty of sin. If I had not done among them the works that no one else did, they would not have been guilty of sin."
Yeah, those are pretty strong statements. And Dr. Peterson points out that these are not meant to be taken literally. Humanity was already accountable for sin before Jesus came.
Right.
But the meaning here is comparative. By rejecting Jesus, the ultimate revealer of God and the giver of life, their guilt is amplified immeasurably. It's a way of highlighting the profound responsibility that comes with encountering Jesus.
Okay, so it's like their sin is greater because they've rejected the one who could have forgiven them.
Exactly. And Dr. Peterson draws a parallel to Jesus' strong condemnations of the scribes and Pharisees in Matthew. It's about conveying the extreme seriousness of their rejection.
Okay, so this helps us understand the apparent tension between John 3.17, which says that Jesus wasn't sent to condemn the world, and John 9.39, which says that Jesus came into the world for judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Peterson explains that both are true.
They are, yeah. Jesus's primary mission was salvation, but his very presence inevitably brings about judgment as a consequence for those who refuse to believe.
Okay, so it's like greater light brings greater accountability.
Exactly. Think about the cities of Capernaum and Bethsaida, where Jesus performed many miracles.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus said that their judgment would be more severe than that of Sodom and Gomorrah because they had seen his works and still rejected him.
Wow, that's sobering.
It is, and it's a reminder that we can't take the gospel lightly. Our response to Jesus matters.
Okay. Dr. Peterson also addresses the seeming contradiction between John 5.31, where Jesus says, "If I bear witness about myself, my testimony is not true." And John 8.14, where he says, "Even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true."
Mm-hmm.
And he points out that John often presents these apparent contradictions to make us think, to dig deeper, to consider the context.
Exactly. He wants us to wrestle with the text, not just skim over it.
Right. And he explains that in John 5.31, Jesus is speaking within a specific legal context.
Mm.
If his testimony relied solely on himself, without any other corroborating witness, it wouldn't be legally valid.
Right. It's like the principle of needing two or three witnesses to establish the truth of a matter.
Exactly.
And as it turns out, the very next verse in John 5 introduces another witness, the Father himself, who testifies about Jesus.
Okay, so the apparent contradiction is resolved when we understand the context.
Exactly, and that's often the case with John. He likes to challenge our assumptions, to make us think, to push us to a deeper understanding.
Yeah, he's not afraid to make us uncomfortable, to make us wrestle with difficult questions.
He's not. And ultimately, it's all for our good, because it forces us to engage with the truth of the gospel on a deeper level.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground today. We've explored double meaning, chiasm, variation, the crucial role of Old Testament connections, ethical dualism, and hyperbole. And it's amazing to see how intentional John was in crafting his message.
Absolutely. It's like he was a master chess player, carefully planning every move, every word to achieve his ultimate goal, which was to present Jesus to the world in all his glory and power.
Yeah, I love that analogy. And I think it's important to remember that as we read John's gospel, we're not just reading a story, we're engaging with a work of art, a theological masterpiece.
Exactly. And as we become more familiar with John's style, with his techniques, with his way of thinking, we'll be able to appreciate the richness and depth of his message even more.
So for you, our listener, what are some practical takeaways from all of this? How can you apply this knowledge to your own reading of John's gospel? Well, first of all, be aware of these stylistic features. Look for those double meanings, those structural patterns, those echoes of the Old Testament. Consider the ethical contrasts that John presents and pay attention to his use of hyperbole. Ask yourself, what is John trying to emphasize here? What is he trying to convey? How does his unique approach shape my understanding of Jesus and his message?
Exactly. Don't just skim over the surface, but dig deeper. Wrestle with the text. Ask questions. And as you do, you'll discover that John's gospel is not just a historical account of Jesus' life, but a profound and challenging invitation to encounter the living God.
So I encourage you, our listener, to revisit a familiar passage in John's gospel with these stylistic elements in mind and see what new insights you discover. And until next time, happy reading.
And may your journey through John's gospel be filled with wonder and discovery.